So yeah, my goal today as someone who has zero expertise and experience in quantum computing is not to try to sit here and, you know, tell you all what the most important and pressing ethical issues are in quantum computing, but instead to kind of take my own research and teaching and thinking about the ethics of AI and machine learning more generally over the past 5 or 6 years, lay out what I take to be 6 of the most pressing areas, and then have that sort of act as a way to start a discussion about if and when and how these ethical issues might apply to specific applications in quantum. So anyone who's been, you know, following the news recently, if you didn't know about AI ethics before, you probably do now. A few months ago, the Future of Life Institute put out this widely circulated open letter calling for a pause on the development of AI systems more powerful than GPT-4. And so as of this week, you know, that was signed over 31,000 times, right? And so more recently, last week, the Center for AI Safety out of Berkeley similarly released a statement. I mean, it's almost weird to call it a statement because it's like one sentence about the potential existential risks posed by artificial intelligence with some very notable and high-profile signatories. And so I think that while these kinds of calls about the potential existential risks of AI and the sort of long-term potentially damaging implications of runaway AI take up a lot of headlines and take up a lot of space and engage our imagination in interesting and sometimes terrifying ways, I don't want to get too caught up in that hype, right? And so I don't want to downplay the potential existential risk of these technologies, but I also think that there are more fundamental and kind of closer to the ground, practical, everyday considerations about the ethics of AI and machine learning that are worth our attention. So why think about AI ethics at all? Well, if someone asked me, you know, like I'm a professor of ethics, right? And they say, well, what is ethics about? I say, well, fundamentally, ethics is about living a good, admirable life. So one thing that ethicists think about is like what goes into a human life going well. And so when I step back and I think, okay, well, like what are some of the most important decisions that people will make in their lives? Like what are the most consequential, impactful decisions they have to make? And, you know, if I had to make a list of, say, 5 or 6 important life decisions that people make, for me, here are probably 4, right? So education, choosing if and when and where to go to college or university, your career path, right? So what kind of career you want to move into after your studies. Getting a mortgage, and I can say as a first-time home purchaser here in Canada, that is a very, very weighty decision with very long-term financial implications. So owning a home and relationships, right? Getting married, whether or not to get married. And so, you know, when I'm thinking about the decisions that most people make that will have the sort of widest-ranging, longest-lasting impacts on their lives, these seem like 4 areas where they should be on that list, right, of most important decisions people would make. And so what's striking to me about all 4 of these kinds of decisions that people make is that they're increasingly mediated by algorithms powered by artificial intelligence and machine learning, right? And so admissions decisions into universities are not only screened by AIs, but there's AI assistance to help you generate more competitive applications to various programs, right? Long before ChatGPT arrived on the scene, there were AI algorithms doing the first pass and scan at resumes to decide, you know, who actually gets to talk to a human recruiter and who's rejected out of hand. Creditworthiness is assessed by AI algorithms, and as we know, like there are all kinds of machine learning and psychometrics that go into the compatibility algorithms and online dating sites, right? And so when we recognize that ethics is fundamentally about what it is to live a good human life, and then we think about what are the most important decisions people will make in their lives, the fact that those decisions now are very much mediated by tools powered by artificial intelligence and machine learning makes it seem to me that AI and ethics are inextricable, right? That we can't really think about what it means to live a good human life now while ignoring AI, right? The tools are just there. It's like it's impossible to ignore them in the kind of lives that we live here today. And then I think the flip side of that's also true, right? That it's impossible to think about developing AI and machine learning technologies without an eye towards their ethical and social implications. So what I want to do then today, as I mentioned at the outset, is just give you all like a high-level overview that can be a conversation starter for what I think are some of the most important issues in this area. And so I'm calling this the probes model. So the six issues that I wanna briefly sort of review with you today, probes is the acronym, right? Privacy, responsibility, opacity, bias, equity, and sustainability. And so I'll sort of go through each of these in turn, again, with the overarching goal that this is the kind of first word in a conversation, not the last word about this is what's, you know, important once and for all. All right, so the first area that's worth discussing is data privacy, right? So it's no secret by now that the advances we've seen in artificial intelligence and machine learning systems are due in large part to the increasing availability of large training data sets, right? So as we get more and more data to train on, we can build more and more sophisticated models. And so, of course, the data that comprises those growing and ever larger training data sets reflect more and more intimate parts of our lives. Right? And so I think it's for that reason that questions about data privacy have taken center stage in lots of the debates about AI ethics. And so the first thing I want to do in the talk here is just take on an argument that I often hear made, which is, I think, compelling and somewhat intuitive and plausible, but ultimately wrong or misleading or incorrect. Right? And the argument basically goes something like this, like, well, why should we care so much about privacy, right? If you don't have anything to hide, why do you care about privacy, right? If you're not doing like weird, creepy stuff on the internet, like why do you really care about privacy? It shouldn't really matter unless you're doing something illegal or weird or creepy. And so again, I think that's like intuitive, it's plausible, I understand why people would think that, but I think it's a seriously, seriously mistaken view. Right? And so to illustrate this, I'm gonna draw on and expand upon a thought experiment first proposed in the 1970s by the political philosopher James Rachels. And so it's meant to be provocative, but it is a thought experiment, and it basically goes like this. Like, imagine that your mother-in-law is always in the corner of your bedroom. Like she never leaves. She's just always there, right? So if you put yourself in that gross and kind of provocative headspace for a minute, if your mother-in-law is always in the bedroom, then you ask yourself, like, what would that do to my relationship with my spouse or my partner, right? I think it's safe to say for most people, it would reduce the amount of intimacy you were willing to take part in, right? Be that physical intimacy, emotional intimacy, right, what have you. And so the idea there is that like we change our behavior in significant ways in the presence of some kinds of people, right? We behave very differently when our mother-in-law's in the room than when she's not. We, you know, interact very differently with our superiors or our PIs than we do with our friends or our children, right? And so I think that's a crucial part of what it is to be human, right? Humans evolved. We're the most social species on the planet, and arguably that sociality is what led to, you know, humans' evolutionary success, right? It's crucial to who we are that we're able to switch back and forth between these many social roles, right? And so with this thought experiment with the mother-in-law in your bedroom is meant to do is to sort of get you thinking about like, well, if she was always there, then you wouldn't really ever be able to engage in intimacy with your partner. And then if you weren't ever able to engage in intimacy with your partner, then it sort of seems like you wouldn't be able to engage in the kinds of patterns of activity that are characteristic of being in a close relationship, right? And so over time, it just seems like you wouldn't be able to have the kind of intimate relationship that we think is really important for human flourishing, right? We know various forms of human contact, intimacy are just essential for human well-being. And so the idea is that like, if we can't do that, then we can't take part in these social roles that we know are constitutive of a good, flourishing human life full of well-being, right? And so the idea here is that like, we'll replace the mother-in-law with the pervasive and ubiquitous data collection tech companies, data brokers, right? And the idea is like, if there's always potentially someone there, someone listening, or at least the possibility or the potential of someone listening, and we shift our behavior in ways in response to someone listening, that may foreclose the possibility of us having certain kinds of social relationships, right? In the same way, you just like, you can't have an intimate relationship with your partner if your mother-in-law is always there, right? The same might go for other patterns of social interaction that we have, And so the reason that privacy has a value, even if you have nothing to hide, is that we need to be able to control who has access to us. We sometimes have to let people into our lives. We sometimes have to exclude people from our lives. And if we're not able to do that, we're not able to form the kinds of relationships that are crucial for human well-being, right? So that's why privacy matters, even if you're not doing weird, creepy, illegal stuff online, right? So that's why we should care about, you know, data privacy legislation, because it impacts, like, our basic fundamental human sociality, right? So, you know, as with all of the issues I'll consider, there's a lot more to be said about all of this. I'm happy to take it up in the Q&A, but that's just a sort of brief overview of what I think to be some really important and powerful philosophical arguments about the value of privacy, right? So next, I'll talk about a responsibility. So that's the R in this probes model. So, you know, on the first slide I showed this big open letter to pause AI development that was funded and run by the Future of Life Institute. Future of Life Institute is also famous for their campaign to stop killer robots. And so what I think is valuable about the idea of killer robots is that, yes, it's very sci-fi. Yes, it's very provocative. It talks about, you know, matters of life and death. But it actually illustrates a more kind of basic or fundamental underlying dynamic that's going to be present as we come to rely on more and more advanced and autonomous artificial intelligence and machine learning systems. Right? So the idea is that, like, we get this really stark example with killer robots, but the same dynamic will be in play in much less dramatic domains. Right? And so the main problem as I see it with killer robots is that it presents us with a dilemma. Right? So imagine for a moment that we have a fully automated, fully autonomous weaponized drone system. And by the way, this is not science fiction. There's preliminary evidence that fully automated weapon systems have been used in the theater of war in Africa, perhaps even also in the conflict in Russia and Ukraine. So this is not the stuff of, like, this might happen in 50 years from now. It's, like, probably happening right now. I mean, it's debatable, but the sort of technology is certainly there. Okay, so we imagine we have this fully weaponized automated drone system that is authorized to identify a target and to initiate a lethal attack on a target without any meaningful form of human oversight or intervention. Right? Now, suppose one of these weapon systems makes a mistake. Right? It identifies and initiates a fatal strike on a non-combatant civilian. Right? So it kills an innocent. Okay. So in the case where an automated system makes that mistake and kills a non-combatant civilian, we're then faced with a dilemma. Okay, because insofar as that system is truly automated, right, that it's operating independent of meaningful forms of human control, we have this dilemma where on the one horn of the dilemma, it says, well, you know, something just went horribly wrong. An innocent person was killed. We have to blame someone. Someone's got to be accountable for this, right? Someone's got to be responsible. But the idea is, like, it doesn't seem right to just, like, punish the robot. Right? What are you going to do? You're going to unplug the drone? Are you going to fine it? I mean, cold comfort to the family, you know, of the person who was innocently killed. You say, oh, I know your son and daughter were killed, but don't worry. We unplugged the drone, right? You say, well, no, that doesn't make sense at all, right? Like a robot is not the kind of thing that can be punished, right? To punish a robot is just to make a mistake. It doesn't seem satisfactory, right? It's not gonna prevent things in the future. It just seems like the wrong thing to do. So it doesn't seem like we can punish the robot, right? But on the other hand, it also doesn't really seem like we can punish some military commander, right? Because insofar as the robot is indeed operating autonomously, independently of human intervention, then we can't really punish a human for it because it doesn't exhibit the two canonical forms for legal and ethical responsibility, which are knowledge and control. Okay, so in law and in the law and in ethics, we usually say in order for someone to be held responsible for their action, they had to have some degree of control over that action, and they had to have some degree of knowledge. You know, they had to know what was going to happen, or they could have reasonably been expected to know what would have happened. And so the idea is that if we blame the commander for the actions of the automated weapon system, we're going to undermine the fundamental concept of liability in the law and ethics that can put us on a very, very slippery slope where all of a sudden people could be held legally liable, they could be held financially liable for the actions of systems over which they had no knowledge and control. Right? And so it seems like in the case of a fully automated weapon system, we're forced to just, like, throw our hands up in the air and say, look, that sucks, innocent people were killed, but like, we can't blame the robot, we can't blame the person, so we just throw up our hands and say, well, no one's to blame, right? But that's deeply, deeply unsatisfactory, right? And so the idea is like, that example makes it stark because it's like a life and death example. But the same dynamics are gonna be in play in, for example, the automated systems that run high frequency trading algorithms. Right? So when they make a mistake and someone loses a bunch of money, you say, well, who to blame? Well, can I blame the manager who had no control over how the algorithms were behaving? No. Does it make sense to fine the algorithm itself? No. And so it just seems like we're forced to throw our hands up and say, well, this bad thing happened, but nothing we can do about it. Okay, so that's a deeply unsatisfactory solution, but it's one that we're going to have to face as AI systems become more and more automated and more independent of meaningful forms of human oversight. Okay, so that's going to be a central question that we'll have to deal with in the domain of law, ethics, insurance, and so forth.
Another example, which is which may be closer to home even than the drone, is with self-driving cars.
Yeah.
Because there have been cases where a Tesla will switch from automated driving back to manual driving a few seconds before a fatal crash, where it's identified it can't avoid the crash, so it's really quick just going to shift the liability to the human so that the company is not liable for it.
And the really important dynamic that I suspect is interesting for folks in this room too is like, it really does matter how we decide to answer those questions in terms of insurance policies and laws and regulations, right? Because if all of a sudden software engineers can be held responsible for the way that a car behaves, well, you're going to have to pay people a lot more to take on that risk in developing those cutting edge technologies. Right? On the other hand, if we want to develop a strict liability regime where we just say we're not even going to bother with trying to assign responsibility for a case of a crash, right? But when an automobile crashes, you just file a claim, you get a payout. That's a very different form of insurance than we currently have in much of North America. Right? And so that's going to fundamentally reshape insurance markets in ways that can be quite disruptive. Okay, so this is sort of on the one hand, it's like, yeah, it's like the stuff of philosophy thought experiments. But on the other, it has very practical implications for the kinds of jobs for engineers, for example, that are working on these cutting-edge technologies. So as before, you know, much more that could be said. Happy to continue the conversation in Q&A, but I'll leave it there for the idea of responsibility. Okay, so next I want to talk about opacity. It's the O in the probes model, otherwise known as the black box problem. And so anyone who's followed any developments in AI and machine learning over the past 20 years will, of course, be aware of the charge, right, that these systems are black boxes. And so that's true. It's been much discussed. What I want to do today is just highlight what I think is an underappreciated aspect of why black boxes are a problem and why we ought to care about them, right? So, if we think about what makes humans unique and different from all other species that have evolved on the planet, I mean, there's lots of different criteria you could use. Some of them are more controversial than others, but one of the ones that seems decisive to me is that humans and no other animals engage in what the philosopher Wilfred Sellers calls the game of giving and asking for reasons, right? So, you know, if my neighbor's dog barks every time I come home, but it doesn't bark every time my wife comes home. We just say, all right, well, that's just the dog being the dog, right? Like, I don't demand that the dog explain, hey, why do you bark at me but not her, right? That doesn't make sense to ask that question of a dog, right? But if my neighbor, on the other hand, is very polite and friendly to me, but very cold and hostile to my wife, then I can say, like, hey, wait a minute, man, like, why are you so nice to me, but so mean, you know, so mean to her? Like, you gotta give me an explanation for that. You gotta give a reason, right? And so humans are unique in the fact that we demand that people give reasons for their actions, and we have internalized the idea that others can ask of reasons of us, and then we have to give reasons, right? Arguably, that idea, that game of giving and asking for reasons, is at the core of human morality. Right? It's that sets us apart from all other primate species. It's probably that's at the heart of the kind of hyper-cooperative nature that allowed our species to evolve and to flourish into the dominant species on the planet, right? It's this capability of giving and asking for reasons. And so seen through that lens, I think that gives us some nice purchase on why it is that black box algorithms are so worrisome from an ethical and legal perspective, right? So, for those, you know, who might not know, the kind of blurred out image in the background here is from the famous MNIST training data set. So this is like the kind of standard image classification task for deep learning, where you can, you know, recognize handwritten digits. So it was one of the first commercial applications of deep learning to sort mail at the, you know, post office in Buffalo. And so what is really striking about this example is that because it's been used for so long and so well studied, we're able to use various kind of explainable AI techniques like deconvolution to be able to look at activation layers in the neural network and see, well, what features of these handwritten digits is the neural net keying in on to distinguish a 6 from an 8, for example. Right? And if you look at these features in the digits, they're very, very different from the features that you would see if you did a human eye tracking study, right? And you know, we're looking at, well, what features would a human be keying in on if you put a digit behind some kind of Gaussian filter and ask, hey, is that a 6 or an 8? Right? The features that a human brain would key in on are very, very different than the ones that deep neural networks would. Right? And so this is a kind of double-edged sword. Okay, because on the one hand, I think it's precisely because these systems process information very differently from human brains that we get superhuman performance in these kind of narrow domains like image classification. Right? So I think it's precisely because they don't, because they build their own representations of a classification schema that make them so powerful. Right? But it's a double-edged sword because they build the representations without any regard whatsoever for human semantic explanations. Right? It's not done with an eye towards how could a human explain this, right? It's done in a ruthlessly optimizing way to increase accuracy, right, and to decrease errors. And so I think that's what's so, I think, scary or tricky or worrisome about black box algorithms, that they're just not capable of giving reasons in a way that's interpretable and understandable to humans. And when we deploy these tools in high-stakes domains like finance and medicine and the military, that's where the real risk comes in, right? So when the doctor says, look, you know, the terminal diagnosis is 6 months, you only have 6 months to live, right? It's fair for us to say, well, wait a minute, like, how do you know that? What are you basing that on? What's your evidence for that? Are there alternatives? Can I get a second opinion? Right? That kind of back and forth of giving and asking for reasons is crucial in these high-stakes domains, but it's precisely the inability of black box algorithms to give those reasons or explanations in a way that makes sense to humans, right? That is designed for human understanding that makes them, I think, so worrisome. Right? And so all of this raises what I think is one of the most important questions as AI systems become more and more developed, which is that, like, is a double standard proper? Right? Should we be holding AI to the same standards as human decisions? Or should there be a higher standard for AI? Right? Because some people like to point out, look, if I ask you all, like, what did you have for breakfast this morning and why did you decide that? You know, why did you decide to have oatmeal rather than yogurt? Right? There's some sense in which, like, that process is probably opaque to you. Right? Probably it just has to deal with, like, which one showed up first in your, you know, line of sight. But, like, in a way, much of our own decision-making is opaque to us. And so you might think that, well, if human decision-making is opaque to even humans, well, why would we hold AI to an even higher standard than we hold humans to? Right? And so those are the kinds of questions that I think are going to be front and center of the ethical and legal and regulatory landscape. Is it appropriate to hold AI to the same standards that we hold human forms of judgment to, or might differing standards be justified? Okay, so that's all I'll say about the black box problem. On to bias. And so there's been so much written about this over the past, you know, 5 or 6 years. You can do an entire graduate seminar just on the problem of algorithmic bias and algorithmic fairness. And so I just want to highlight what I think are two underappreciated areas of this domain. Then again, we can, you know, discuss it further during the Q&A or the discussion afterwards. So I really love this paper by Sina Faisalpour and Dave Danks, where they give a sort of taxonomy about all the different senses in which an algorithm can be said to be biased, and all the domains in which it can be biased, and it gives just a really nice way of organizing the kind of logical space of what bias is, where it comes from, and how you might address it. Right? So in this paper, they use this running example of university admissions as their kind of touchstone or the case they return to. So I'll just highlight a few pieces from this that I think are underappreciated. Right? And so I think that we often tend to think about bias in terms of this idea of like data being biased, right? So if you train a model on historically biased data, of course it's going to learn those historical relationships are biased, right? Garbage in, garbage out. And so that's obvious, it's true, it's important, it's well documented, it's widespread, right? I don't want to deny that at all. However, I think that there's like a prior step that is equally as important but not as often discussed, which is the way that the manner in which we specify a problem is one in which the decisions that we make can be biased against certain groups or in favor of others, right? And so if we just think about the example of algorithms used to accept or deny people into university programs or to decide, you know, who gets funding or who gets scholarships, the very first question you have to ask, even before you start collecting data, even before you start building a predictive model, is like, what is the variable that we're trying to predict, right? What's the target variable? And so if you're thinking about, you know, we want to predict something like student success, right? So we want to figure out who the high-risk first-year students are so that we make sure that they get the support they need so that they can stay in their program. You might think, well, yeah, like obviously the target variable, the thing we want to predict is student success, right? But of course, like student success is could be many things to many different people in many different contexts, right? GPA could be a measure or a proxy for student success. Post-graduation salary could be a metric for student success. Prestige of job placement could be a metric for student success, right? And all of these are reasonable ways to operationalize that variable, right? But the key point is that there's no purely objective, data-driven way to figure out what's the best way to optimize this target variable of student success, right? There's just no objective answer to that question. It depends on values, it depends on the context, right? And as such, because it's a value-driven decision, it's one in which there is the potential for various forms of bias, be it at the individual level, the social level, or the systemic level, to enter into that decision, right? And so I just highlight that as a way to say, while the kind of bias data that gets a lot of attention in the media and in the literature is important, we shouldn't overlook this prior step, right? About the way that we specify problems in the first place is an underappreciated way in which bias can enter into the equation. Right, so the same goes, again, the idea of bias in modeling and validation comes up a lot, the ways in which error rates for predictive models can vary as a function of different demographic characteristics, right? That has, again, rightly received a lot of attention, especially following the publication of, you know, Julia Engwin's famous Wall Street Journal investigative article showing the racial bias in recidivism algorithms, right? That was very much focused on this idea of bias that comes in the form of modeling and validation, right? Where the error rates differ among historically marginalized groups. Okay, so the last setting to sort of highlight here, again, I think that's underappreciated in addition to the other two in the middle that are, again, rightfully discussed, is the way that AI and predictive systems have a sort of bias of their own in that they can create feedback loops, right, in a way that can be very hard to model and account for, right? They can create distribution shifts in data that, if you're not careful, can skew future predictions. Right, and so to go back to the admissions example here, the way you demonstrate this is that if you build a predictive system to try to figure out, you know, what at-risk groups are most at need of, in most need of student aid, for example, well, that data-driven decision informs a policy that distributes aid in a certain way, and it, you know, includes some people and excludes other people. Well, that in turn shifts the distribution the next year of students who are succeeding or not succeeding. And so any sort of sampling from that second year cohort is impacted by that algorithmic decision made in the first, right? And so these feedback loops can be created whereby the algorithmic intervention changes the world that you're trying to model in a way that if you don't account for it, right, you'll mistakenly assume, you know, you may mistakenly apply causality to a cause that wasn't present were it not for the algorithmic intervention. Right, and so this is sort of what's known in the literature as, yeah, data evolution, right, and feedback loops. And so, again, much more to say about all that, but that's where I'll leave it for the discussion of bias here. Okay, so on to the E in the PROBES model. So equity and the digital divide. So, you know, much of my work over the past, like, year or two is focused on AI applications in healthcare generally, mental health specifically. And so I think that the COVID-19 pandemic provided a really stark example of the ways that kind of emerging digital technologies have this potential to widen existing gaps or existing forms of inequality. Right, so, you know, if you can remember back to the beginning of the pandemic when, like, all of a sudden all of our medical appointments just got, like, shifted online, right? And, like, telehealth was basically overnight, you got more adoption of telehealth in about 5 days than we did in, you know, 5 years prior. And so with that came a just absolute flood of venture capital and funding for various digital health startups. Right? And so what was so striking to me and some of the, you know, my collaborators who work on this project is the ways in which the advances in digital health specifically tailored to the risks tied to the COVID-19 pandemic exacerbated existing inequalities, right? So we know, and it was clear at the time, it's clear as day now, that those most at risk from COVID-19 were the elderly, right? They're the most vulnerable groups, and yet these seem to be the groups that are the least likely to benefit from advances in digital health technologies, right? Owing to things like unreliable access to broadband or not having fluency in the digital platforms that are used to deliver these healthcare services. And so I think what that example shows is that, you know, despite well intentions and despite, you know, that some groups did benefit tremendously and that we've made huge strides in some ways for accessibility to health resources through digital platforms, that's true, and it like benefits those who are already fluent digitally, right? It disadvantages those who were not digitally fluent or didn't have reliable access to broadband, for example. And insofar as things like unreliable access to broadband are also correlated with or comorbid with other forms of health inequalities, right, then these digital interventions, these emerging technologies are going to serve to just widen that gap. Right? And so I think with the health example, again, that's like one case study. I think it applies to AI, quantum systems more generally. What it should do, what that example should get us to do is get in the habit of asking, right, who's going to benefit from this technology? Right? Who benefits when it goes well? Who bears the risks of developing it? Right? If it goes poorly, who's going to be disadvantaged? Right? Who decides how those risks and benefits are distributed? And who decides who decides? Right? And so I think that that last question really should help us to focus in on what I take to be an incredibly plausible idea that like those people who are most impacted by a given decision should have a say in that decision. Right? That seems very plausible and intuitive to me. But what we see with the development of a lot of AI machine learning technologies is that the people who are most impacted by them often have no say whatsoever in, you know, how they're used. Right? I mean, how many of you consented to have your Reddit posts included in the training data set for GPT-3, right? I mean, none of us did, right? By definition, we didn't consent. And so this idea that like, if you're impacted by the technology, you ought to have a say in how it's developed is one that I think gives voice to these increasing calls and initiatives you see for more participatory and participant-driven approaches to AI and machine learning. So again, happy to talk about that, more about that if anyone's interested. Okay, so the last few slides here, sustainability and the hidden environmental and human costs. So I think it's very easy to think about artificial intelligence and machine learning systems as like these cloud-based systems. You know, they're kind of ephemeral. They're, you know, think, you know, computation just happens in the cloud. Intelligence is like this sort of nebulous thing that happens at the network level. And a lot of the rhetoric and the hype around technology certainly reinforces that view. But as Kate Crawford, probably more than anyone else, has shown in her 2021 book, The Atlas of AI, like, there is a planetary and digital and human labor cost to these technologies, right? There are rare earth minerals that are required to build supercomputers, right? Those are often mined in countries where people put their bodies and livelihoods at enormous risk in mining operations, right? Computers require and server farms require massive amounts of water and cooling that are often subsidized by local governments at high rates. As this has become increasingly clear with large language models, right? The sort of secret sauce that makes ChatGPT, you know, as successful as it is this technique known as reinforcement learning from human feedback. Well, what does reinforcement learning from human feedback require? Well, it requires an army of human annotators, right? Who are saying, you know, yes, this output is helpful or truthful or useful, or it's toxic, right? It's biased, it should be eliminated, right? Those are like human beings that have to label these data sets, right? There's a human labor cost to this. It's not ephemeral, it's not something that happens automatically. There are like actual human beings having to do this, and much of the rhetoric and discussion sort of makes or it renders that labor and that human work invisible, right? And so, this chart is almost quaint now, right? So this was from a famous 2018 paper by Struble et al. You know, back in the days when transformer models had 213 million parameters, right? It's almost cute, like, aw, your tiny little models, that's so sweet. And like, even back in this 2019 paper, right, you can see that training a model with 213 million parameters, and, you know, by comparison, GPT-4 is on the order of trillions of parameters now, orders of magnitude greater, you can see the expected impact in terms of carbon footprint, right? And so the electricity, and cooling and sort of all the infrastructure required to build and train these models is one that has a tangible impact on the environment, right? And so, you know, far from being this like cloud technology that doesn't have any impact, right? These are physical materials involving human labor, involving significant cost to the planet and the environment that we just can't ignore as we think about the next generation of these technologies. All right. So where I want to wrap up then is with a kind of meta question, right? So I'm a philosopher. We like to say, anything you can do, I can do meta. I can do anything more meta than you. Okay, so the meta question is this, right? To what degree are AI, machine learning, and quantum computing systems like genuinely novel? Right? So consider this. Pretty much every society that have been studied by anthropologists have some version of this rule, don't harm innocent people. Okay, and of course cultures will differ on what counts as harm and who counts as innocent, but like pretty much every culture ever studied has this rule of don't harm innocent people. Okay, so what's interesting about this rule is that it holds true whether we're talking about a prehistoric civilization that can mostly only harm people with sticks and stones, or we're talking about, you know, 21st century civilizations that have, you know, nuclear weapons and firearms, right? So, you know, thinking about all the technological development that went into the sticks and stones era to the nuclear era, right? The rule or the framework, don't harm innocent people, it still holds true, right? It was as equally true when the best weapons we had were rocks as they are when the best weapons we have are, you know, atomic missiles, right? So that's a case where there's kind of a continuity. Right? The same ethical framework seems to apply equally well even across the span of like massive technological chain and development. So now, on the other hand, consider something like broadcast advertising versus targeted advertising. Okay, so if you look back to like codes of conduct and, you know, codes of ethics from like 1950s, you know, marketing associations, right? You can sort of tell in that context that there's this assumption that, like, you know, when you place an ad on the radio or you place an ad on broadcast television, like everyone who's sitting in the living room is going to hear the same ad, right? And that's just sort of assumed at that time, right? But of course, now we all live in a world where, you know, I can be sitting on the couch on my New York Times app and I see a different ad than my wife who's sitting on the couch next to me who, like, I, you know, she like steals my password, and so it's literally the same account on a different phone and sees a different advertisement, right? On the very same account, on the very same app, sitting in the very same geographic space, right? And so to me, that seems like a case where if your existing regulations and codes of ethics are assuming, yeah, everyone in the same room sees the same advertisement, right? That kind of framework, that rule, that regulation is just not adequate to address the changes in technological development, right? Like, we need new concepts, we need new tools, we need new ideas to figure out what we do with hyper-targeted advertising, right? And so then the big question is, like, are the credible and near-term applications of artificial intelligence, machine learning, and quantum systems, are they more like the, you know, sticks and stones example, or is it more like the targeted ad example? Right? So is it the case that with these credible applications, the existing law and ethics and framework we have is going to be adequate and we just update it a little bit? Or do the credible applications of these technologies require us to form new frameworks, right? New ethical considerations? And I guess if you think it's the latter, right? So if you think that like the targeted ads is sort of like, that's kind of like the direction we're heading, right? Where these credible applications of quantum computing systems and AI systems are ones that are radically unlike anything that came before it, and that we need new regulations, we need new frameworks to deal with the challenges that they pose. Well, that in turn raises the question of like, who's gonna make those rules, right? Who's gonna come up with those new concepts? Who's gonna come up with those new frameworks, right? And there's a cautionary tale to be had here. So does anyone know the story of this t-shirt? Yeah? So like, for those that don't, you know, again, it seems like this quaint time, right? You know, back when Mark Zuckerberg went to testify in front of the US Congress for the first time, right? This was like back before they were on Capitol Hill every week. But when he went to do it for the very first time, you know, he's very stern, he's answering all the senators' questions about Facebook. And then, so then Orrin Hatch, who at the time, I think he was 84, he was the longest serving senator in the United States. You know, he was initiating his question of Mark Zuckerberg, and he said, you know, Mr. Zuckerberg, like, is it the case that Facebook is free? And he says, yes, Senator, it's like it's a free platform and we intend to keep it that way. And he says, okay, well, how do you make money, right? And then so for the first time during the whole testimony, Zuckerberg gets this like ear-to-ear grin on his face and he says, Senator, we run ads, right? Like not 5 minutes after that, they're printing these t-shirts at Facebook, right? Senator, we run ads. The stock price for Facebook you know, gets one of these hockey stick curves, right? And like, there's a lesson to be learned about the t-shirt, I think, right? And the lesson is, like, if the people who are building the technologies aren't the ones leading the conversation about who's gonna make these new rules, who's gonna make these new regulations, right? If the people who know about it, if they're not the ones leading that conversation, well, like, who's gonna do it, right? And the worry is that if it's not the people building the technologies, then it's gonna be the Orrin Hatches of the world. It's gonna be the crusty 84-year-old senators who don't understand the basic business model of the internet who are gonna be in charge of making the rules, and that's a situation in which I think no one benefits. I think that's a lose-lose situation, right? So that's, in a way, a bit of a plea for the people who are building the technologies to be the ones leading the conversation about the ethics, law, and policy frameworks that ought to regulate or govern them. So again, I'm not the expert in quantum. I leave that up to you to assess the degree to which this framework, right, to which these concepts can apply to the credible applications of quantum technology. And so with that, I want to thank you for your attention and welcome your questions. Oh, right.
Hey, thanks, Gus. We have time for some questions.
Thanks for the very nice talks. I enjoyed it much more than I thought. I have one.
You have no idea. That warms my heart. So it's, yeah.
I have one question. I don't know whether it's central or not, but it was a bit confusing to me when you mentioned that societies have this general rule that they don't harm innocents. So, yeah. Like, it's just in contrast to what I would have thought. So it's like when you look at raiding Mongol hordes or tribes that were killing people from the other tribes, so it's like you have killing, raiding, and robbing them of everything. And then you have, like, then I thought, okay, maybe it's you don't harm people that are within your society. And then what comes up is, okay, you can look at the Second World War with the Holocaust, and so you're basically expelling a part of your own society, and then you're harming them. And then I thought, okay, maybe there is this expelling people from your own society, but then you look at, for example, Putin sending his own people, innocent people, as cannon fodder to die. So it's like, I don't understand it.
Well, so, like, okay, and so these are all totally valid, right? And so, like, what I think I said in the talk holds true, right, which is that every society has that rule. They just differ on who counts as innocent. Right, so I think probably in all those cases, the historical cases that you listed, right, the groups being harmed or persecuted were not perceived of as innocent.
A huge portion of Nazi rhetoric was in service of finding ways to demonize that population, labeling that group as non-innocent.
Yeah.
So yeah.
But yeah, and like, but look, I mean, the bigger point is, like, for me, it's interesting because it's this example of a rule. And again, just because society has a rule doesn't mean everyone follows it. Right, but I mean, there's just really convincing evidence. Some of the most convincing evidence I've seen on this point looks at like text mining studies of obituaries. Right, so obituaries are really nice ways to get a sense of what a society values, and you can sort of extract these latent semantic features from obituaries, and you see and various kinds of codes of ethics and laws. Right, and you combine these together, and you see, like, almost every society has a rule like that and values it. And so what's interesting about it is that it just seems to apply equally well whether you're talking about a completely technologically naive society or an incredibly advanced technological society, right? So in the case of don't harm innocents, that's like, you know, that's gonna be true whether or not we ever get quantum computers or not, right? And so then the question is, like, how much of the credible applications of these technologies are kind of like that? Or how much, you know, or what percentage of them are genuinely novel, such that we need new ways to think about it because the old existing ways are outdated. So that's kind of what it was meant to show. But I think all the examples are totally valid. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thanks, Gus, for the talk. I think the acronym is very useful to remember all the aspects of what's being.
I should,
discussed.
And I have to give due credit here. That was all ChatGPT. I did not think of that by myself. So.
Oh, really? What a plot twist.
Did you, like, hate the talk now? Did you lost all respect now?
I was quite confused about the argument you presented, though, for the nothing to hide argument.
Oh, yeah?
I've been thinking about that for a long time, too, but I thought the key aspect of it really was that the human-to-human relationship is very different to the human to social network, whatever relationship, you know, it's very different how I perceive this surveillance to how I would perceive another person in the room. You know, it's invisible.
Yeah.
I don't have an intuition for it. Yeah. So I thought that was precisely the reason why people end up not caring. So I was curious whether you have any data to show that there is a change in behavior.
Yeah, so I think, so the way I would interpret that is like you're saying there's a kind of disanalogy between the case of like a physical identifiable person, like your mother-in-law sitting in the room versus the kind of passive like echo dot or kind of, you know, like inhuman, inanimate object, right? And so it's definitely true that that is a disanalogy. Now, the worry still holds though, right? That like, I think there's a wealth of evidence from social psychology that people do behave differently when they believe they're being watched, whether or not they're actually being watched. Right, so the mere perception of being watched is enough to alter people's behavior for better or worse in significant ways. And so to me, like the takeaway from that is that you're probably right that people don't care, right? That it's just like, yeah, you know, and you always gotta be careful in these talks, right? Because if I just say, oh yeah, Google, whatever, and then like, you know, it'll turn on my phone and start picking up what I'm saying, right? And the idea is like, well, yeah, like people don't really care, and we do think that like privacy doesn't have a value unless we have something to hide. And I guess the claim here is that like we're just not justified in thinking that, right? The fact that like negative implications haven't come as a result of conversations that Google or Alexa overheard or whatever, that's not a good enough reason to undermine the fundamental value of privacy. So I think I agree with you that people have those attitudes. My view is just that they're not justified in having them, and that we probably don't have a good enough sense of like what we're giving up or what we risk giving up if we just throw up our hands and say like, well, we have nothing to hide, so who cares about privacy? I think there's much more at stake than that.
Hmm. Yeah, perhaps just to reemphasize, like I think it's very important, but you know, I thought you were just saying if you believe you're being watched, right? I thought that was the key point that people... It's so easy to forget that you're being watched in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that's why there's no behavior change.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so being reminded of that is probably a good exercise that we can all engage in, right? Is that, you know, nothing we do online isn't being watched.
To build off of Anna's comment, though, I was thinking something similar when you were talking about this analogy, because I just think of, like, the average person, I usually have to tell them everything they do on their app is being tracked and watched. But at the same time, there have been some interesting like sociological phenomenons where people think that their phones are actively, auditorily monitoring their conversations. And people have done some studies and they were, you know, maybe inclusive. People think that that's not happening. But the bottom line is that the surveillance is so effective that they don't need to listen to what you're saying to know exactly what you're thinking about.
No, you don't need audio. You've got location data, you've got purchase history, you've got social network effects. You don't need audio.
And so what I find really interesting is that even like my father-in-law, who's 75, will talk to me about being worried that his phone is listening in on him, feeling surveyed by the phone. And even though the physical mechanism for how it is doing that, he's wrong about that, the fact that he's worried about it in that way shows me that like this is still an issue that people care about, even if they may not understand the mechanism by which the surveillance...
Yeah, and I think that's like, yeah, it does call for the importance of like, we need more research on the ways that people's attitudes shift and why. I think there was one more. Yeah?
Just that we're running short on time, I know there's a lot of questions, but just to say we're going to have an extended discussion session on this topic, and Gus will be there to... So maybe we'll just take one more question, and Mattia, maybe, can we take yours in the discussion session? And because Ben has the cube already, so maybe that'll be our last question.
No, go ahead. I'll ask later.
Okay, so Mattia.
And then, it's going to be in the Sky Room, right? That's the...
Maybe I'll say this again, but after this, we're going to head to the Sky Room. I'm going to lead everyone there out the back door, and we're going to have a continued discussion about ethics and how it can apply at the intersection of quantum and AI. So let's go to our last question.
Not to toot my own horn, but I think this might be a good question to conclude things. So I was hoping to kind of pick your brain on something, because my personal worry is that all of these are very valid concerns and there are some good points you're making, but at the end of the day, I'm worried that this will end up like any broad, like far-reaching discussion ends in the age of the internet, which is what one group yelling at the other group, and just the responsibility of actually doing anything diffuses into like it's shifted by the experts. Oh, we need more education for people who don't understand things. People who don't understand things say, oh, but the experts are not explaining things to us. It just kind of ends up in a shouting match, or some metaphorically appropriate analogy of a shouting match.
Yeah.
My question for you is what's your most optimistic outcome of looking at this? Like, how do you see this evolving if you were kind of asked nicely to interpret this in a way which might kind of end well for all of us?
Yeah, I mean,
what's going on that gives you hope?
Yeah, so if I have my optimistic hat on, like, I think that there's just demonstrable instances of progress in this space, right? So, like, now, if you go and search around for companies building algorithms for HR, right? So companies that claim to do HR analytics powered by AI, right? Almost all of the companies in their demo will include something about their product having been subjected to an ethical audit. And they feel the need to, in their marketing materials, include the fact that it's not biased, that it doesn't contravene existing anti-discrimination laws, right? And 5 years ago, that was unthinkable, right? So now when I see like the marketing material, right, making claims about ethics and bias, to me, like, that means it's been sort of integrated at the sort of social and business level in a way that, like, you can't ignore it and you can't build products without those considerations, right? Does that mean we've solved the problem? Absolutely not. Is there still work to do? Yes. But compared to like 5 years ago, right, you couldn't publish an academic paper about bias in hiring algorithms, and then a lot of these high-profile studies come out, and now you can't market these products to companies without saying something about it. That's a significant shift to me, right? That shows me that there has been progress that's been made. So that's like one small example, but I think it can generalize a little bit, and that's the sort of thing that does make me optimistic. Okay, so to the Sky Room.
Yes, so let's thank Gus again for his talk.